This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Good evening, I'm David Gale and welcome to The Informer. Tonight I'm joined by Paul McClure. On tonight's Informer, we will be chatting with Associate Professor Mark Stouvet about the impact of sexually transmitted infections on the gay male population. Then we are joined by Catherine Newton and Kelly Cameron, who are going to chat to us about the intersection of leukemia and the Melbourne Marathon. Associate Professor Mark Stouvet has researched the transmission and impact of sexually transmitted infections and blood-borne viruses among key risk populations, primarily people who inject drugs and men who have sex with men, for more than 12 years. His research interests focus on undertaking innovative epidemiological and public health research and disease surveillance, with particular interest in prospective observational studies and the application of record linkage and biobehavioural data collection to these design studies. What does this all mean? Well, tonight on The Informer, we're joined by Dr. Stouvet from the Burnet Institute to talk about the rise in sexually transmitted disease in the gay men's population. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, thank you very much, David.
Look, it's a big, long intro, and it is pretty jargon-laden, but your specialty at the moment, it was certainly you know a lot about STIs and the increase in STIs among the gay male population in Melbourne. What can you tell us about it?
Yeah, look, our program does a lot of work with the Victorian government and community organisations and clinics around Melbourne in establishing systems to allow us to monitor STI infections, particularly in high-risk populations. What we've seen really over the last decade and a half or so is a significant increase in STI infections in the gay and bisexual population, particularly syphilis and gonorrhea, syphilis over an extended period of time. More recently, we've seen substantial increases in gonorrhea transmission as well amongst gay men in Melbourne.
Now, firstly, we're talking about a decade and a half, so 15 years, which has been during the time that safe sex has always been on the agenda during this period and the use of condoms. But we were talking the other day about syphilis in HIV-positive groups.
What we do see is a concentration of syphilis infections among people living with HIV. As we discussed the other day, that's not necessarily related to any biological susceptibility, that HIV infections make people more susceptible. What's happened over time is, it's really the concentration of sexual networks within communities of people living with HIV. What we have is, a population of, probably around 6,000 people living with HIV in Victoria. The vast majority of those are gay men. To practice protective behaviours and to prevent the transmission of others, the gay community has adopted serosorting as quite a legitimate strategy to enjoy their sex life without putting others at risk of getting HIV. So what that means is that you've got a relatively small network of people having sex with each other. And if syphilis gets into that network, it can transmit quite efficiently through a network of people living with HIV that are having sex with each other, whereas the HIV-negative pool is much larger, and that sort of dilutes the effect to some extent.
And therefore the cross-infection, of course.
Yes, exactly. And what we've seen over the last few years is the emergence of reinfection of syphilis within people living with HIV. So, you know, maybe 5 years ago, we're occasionally seeing a few guys attending high caseload clinics who are living with HIV who might be reinfected, you know, a couple of times in the calendar year. And, you know, over recent years, we're starting to see, you know, that number of reinfections is increasing, but now we're starting to see individuals who are, you know, being diagnosed with repeat syphilis infections 3 or 4 times in a calendar year.
In a calendar year, which is quite amazing.
Yeah, so it really is churn, you know, it's just a churn effect, really. And I think, you know, part of that's, you know, also derived from the simplicity of treatment as well. And, you know, people living with HIV have their regular HIV clinical appointments just to monitor their care. And routine within that is you know, receiving a syphilis blood test when you're having your viral load done. So it's readily detected as well in the population.
Yeah, of course. Also, with the introduction of PrEP-X, the trial, and also people just getting prescriptions of PrEP, whether they're in the trial or not, means that possibly, you know, people are having more regular tests. So really, they should be looking at their full screening of STIs if they're seeing, maybe if they're sexually active and they're seeing a GP, I suppose, for those prescriptions every 3 months. With the PrEP-X trial, there's been an increase in STIs as well, hasn't there?
We have, in as part of the preliminary Vic PrEP trial, there, you know, we haven't released the full results yet, but there are indications of increasing STI infections in the population receiving PrEP. We really need to monitor this on a, you know, on the larger scale with PrEP-X. And, you know, PrEP-X has only been running for a relatively short period of time. So we really need to monitor at a larger population level what the relative impact is going to be, you know, in relation to syphilis and other STIs in the context of PrEP and, you know, the very high likelihood that people are, you know, condomless sex is going to increase over time.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the whole idea of PrEP does, it sort of puts unprotected sex back on the, I was going to say on the menu, but back onto the agenda as far as people are possibly, certainly in serodiscordant relationships, are going to possibly say, well, you know, we don't necessarily need to use condoms anymore, and therefore that might also go on. You know, I think most GPs that I've talked to have said that they expected that spike straight away. What sort of diseases would be sort of most prevalent in those people having unprotected sex that may be on PrEP?
The ones that we're most concerned about are gonorrhea and syphilis. And look, you know, this is really, you know, part of the reason why we brought forward, you know, and approached the Victorian government to support a study like PrEP-X. While we continue to wait for potentially for PBS subsidisation of pre-exposure prophylaxis, is to, you know, a lot of people were getting PrEP, you know, on prescription, but through overseas dispensing online. And those scripts could be refilled essentially, you know, multiple times without necessarily people going back and seeing their clinician and sort of adhering to, you know, what would be, you know, best practice guidelines here. So by implementing, you know, a formal, you know, and larger PrEP program through high caseload clinics, what we're trying to do is establish clinically a best practice sort of regimen for the gay men who, you know, feel that PrEP is the most appropriate way to protect themselves from HIV. So that really means 3 monthly attendances. And at each of those attendances, you know, they get full STI screening. So, you know, while PrEP doesn't obviously protect people from other STIs, we really need to wait and see whether the impact of more people attending, you know, routine 3 monthly appointments and having a test and being treated if they're diagnosed can, to some extent, counteract the impact, the behavioural impact of increases in condomless sex.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's not really a story about, you know, do I use condoms or do I use PrEP? It's also possibly a marriage of the two as prevention strategies. And, I mean, you know, it's to do with the trust in the PrEP and treatment as a prevention rather than, you know, it's sort of like another part of the armoury, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are some studies internationally, the IPREX study, which is probably the most prominent one for the gay community that was headed by Bob Grant out of San Francisco. Actually, you know, a lot of the qualitative work there and the quantitative work showed that people were still using condoms at a reasonable frequency in combination with PrEP. And the qualitative work, you know, sort of suggested that PrEP was really there as a... you know, as a backup to some extent. You know, we know condoms, you know, while they're highly protective, are not infallible. You know, they break, they can be used incorrectly in certain circumstances. They are not 100% efficacious. So, you know, it's interesting the context in which different people will take PrEP on board, and you know, we'd be really interested to see how that evolves over time, whether condomless sex really becomes the new normal and back to the age of free love, so to speak.
Yeah, look, it's great to talk to you again, Mark. It's good to have you on The Informer. And thank you for all the work that you do down at the Burnett Institute. Otherwise, we wouldn't have this information. And we look forward to talking to you again in the future on The Informer.
No problem. I'd be glad to.
Thank you. Bye. Leukemia, lymphoma, myeloma and related blood disorders can develop in anyone of any age at any time. More than 13,000 Australians are expected to be newly diagnosed this year, equivalent to 35 people each day. Now, this morning I read an article in The Age called Bad to the Bone, The Truth About Leukemia, which was really about researchers having observed for the first time how cancer cells attack and destroy the bone of leukemia patients using a new Street View system to zoom in and spy on the invaders. This never-before-seen technique is expected to revolutionise research and new treatments for any type of cancer that spreads to the bone, including from breast, prostate or melanoma. So in close to real time, they're able to watch cancer cells stripping away the bone. One of the immunologists said it was like watching students at a house party trashing a place when the parents were away. But this is quite groundbreaking, and decades of research have improved survival, but sadly not everyone survives. Blood cancer is the second biggest cause of cancer death in Australia. Tonight on The Informer, we're joined by Catherine Newton, a marathon runner, and Kelly Cameron from the Leukemia Foundation, also Andrew Morris, another marathon runner. Hi, welcome, Kelly.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Hello to Andrew as well.
How you going?
Now, the first thing we wanted to talk about was the marathon. Now, the marathon was on Sunday, just gone. A lot of people complained about streets being closed. I'm a marathon runner. I've run marathons. Paul, you haven't yet?
No.
I know, you're looking forward to it.
Won't be anytime soon.
The marathon is an analogy because there's a reason that you decided to run a marathon.
Yeah, that's right. We decided together that we would participate in a marathon to raise money for the Leukemia Foundation, in particular awareness around my boyfriend and Andrew Morris's best mate, Will Morell.
Now, tell me, how did you go, Kelly, in the marathon?
Catherine.
Unfortunately, because Catherine came down with a bad knee injury a couple of weeks beforehand, I had to sadly run the marathon all by myself.
Andrew, come on.
All 4 hours of the marathon I had to run by myself, and it was certainly an interesting experience. I don't know whether I'm going to rush back to another marathon anytime soon, but I think it was all worth it in the end because we had a great campaign.
Andrew, welcome to the four-hour-plus marathon. Look, I haven't done one under 4 hours, but it's tough, isn't it?
It was tough. I did... A bit of a white lie. I did break the 4 hours. So I'm sorry, Dave.
Okay.
It was tough. You know, like you can't really train for it, and you think you're cruising, you think you're having a great time, and then suddenly you just hit a wall, and then you've got no energy left. And,
yeah, it's around about the 35-kilometer mark, 32, 33, and you just go, oh my goodness, what am I doing?
You're running past St Kilda, and you're passing all these great pubs and bars, and you said, I'd much rather go there instead of running the rest of this marathon, but. I'm glad I finished it.
But it is a mental journey as well. Now, in the end, Catherine, you did the half marathon because of your knee injury.
Yeah, that's right. I think I pushed myself too hard in the training in the lead up. I think 3 weeks before the run, I went to the physio in a lot of pain and he told me that I had ITB syndrome, which meant it was risky enough running the half, but I had to pull out and, I still finished a winner. So
yeah, it's mentally tough though, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're sort of coming back towards the city and you sort of go, I could almost be there, and then you have to do another bit and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, that's it.
But why were you doing the marathon? You wanted to raise money for leukemia. Is there a particular reason why?
Yeah, so we both wanted to raise as much money as we could and as much awareness for the Leukemia Foundation, in particular to support Will Morell. So,
who is?
We likened his campaign a little bit to a marathon because, you know, he got sick in February and it's now October and he's still not 100% better. And what he's been through is, you know, a marathon is very fragile, small in comparison. And that was kind of the analogy we kind of ran with. And I think people really received that well. Yeah.
So his leukemia journey is a marathon in itself.
Yeah. Mm.
And I think I read somewhere where you'd mentioned, Catherine, that, you know, you can stop and walk if you get a bit tired or whatever. He can't actually do that.
Exactly.
He doesn't have that choice.
He doesn't. We had the choice in the marathon to stop and walk if we needed, have water or anything. But, at the end of the day, Will has absolutely no stopping. There's nothing stopping him. So, he needs to finish a winner as we did on Sunday.
Look, Kelly Cameron is from the Leukemia Foundation. Now, I was just talking to you earlier about this research that just happened to pop up in the newspaper today. I mean, it's groundbreaking research. What does the Leukemia Foundation do in order to support this sort of research that goes on?
Well, the gorgeous Catherine is actually downplaying her achievements. Catherine set a target of $5,000 within 24 hours of her webpage being up. She kicked that little butt. And
she pretty much tripled it, I think, didn't she?
Yeah, so the final result was over $16,500.
Yeah.
So thanks to Catherine and to her team, we're actually putting millions and millions of dollars into research to try to combat the disease. So basically since 2015, we've put in a milestone of $38 million into research, which is absolutely phenomenal. And we can't do this alone. It's a great partnership that we have with our fundraisers, such as Catherine and Andrew, and we're very, very appreciative of everything that our fundraisers do for the foundation.
And also surprisingly, that research that I was talking about before, that's from researchers at the Parkville Walter and Eliza Hall Institute, as well as in a partnership with London's Imperial College. So a lot of the research is done here in Australia, isn't it?
Yes, that's very correct. And the Walter and Eliza Institute, we've been great supporters of theirs for many years, and we've had a wonderful partnership with them.
Now, the Leukemia Fundraising has another big event each year.
Yeah, we've actually got a few events. I think everybody would have heard of the good old World's Greatest Shave.
Well, yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
Have you shaved at all, Paul?
Well, this week?
Yeah.
Yes, I have.
Okay.
I shave every Monday.
Every Monday,
I hate it.
When is the World's Greatest Shave on?
So World's Greatest Shave is in March, and it's in March every year, one of our biggest fundraising campaigns of the year. We've also just finished up with Light the Night, which is a beautiful event with people coming together to light lanterns of hope, whether that be a gold lantern to remember somebody, a blue one for support, or a white lantern for your personal journey with blood cancer. But the Leukemia Foundation and their fundraisers do events all throughout the year.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're interested in doing some fundraising or attending an event, please go to our website, leukemia.org.au, to register.
Fantastic.
Leukemia, very hard to spell, but what we will do is, you never know whether there's an A before an E or an E after an A or something like that.
Well, if it's a bit easier, give me a call, 1800 620 420.
All right. Well, what I'll do is when we put the podcast up after this episode, we'll make sure that there's a link to the Leukemia Foundation's website and also to your fundraising page as well, Catherine, because, you know, you might have got up to $16,000, $17,000, $18,000. I'd like to see you break through $20,000. So it's never too late to donate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fact that more than 13,000 Australians, and I know that this isn't necessarily, we were talking before, this isn't necessarily an LGBTIQ story, but at the same time, you know, it's affected your partner, and that also means many people in our community are going to be affected by that as well. What can you tell about what can you tell us about Will's story? When did he find out that he had leukemia?
So he found out on the 12th of February, and I think it was about 2 weeks prior to him getting diagnosed where he started to have some symptoms. But prior to that, you know, the most healthy boy. And yeah, it was just such a shock, and we just have to beat it.
Probably about as healthy as you, Andrew.
Yeah.
I think we played golf the day before, actually.
Wow. Yeah.
He's a mad golfer, like much better than me. So, but yeah, we were having a whack the day before, and I think I remember him saying he had blurry eyes, like his vision was gone in the mornings, and he was getting headaches. And then we woke up to a WhatsApp message, and you know that's where it all started.
So it's quite, it hits you quite fast then, and especially.
I think he was complaining to me a little bit about his eyes and his headaches, and you know the girlfriend I am, tell him to you know be a bit stronger,
And I know it's been a few months now since he started treatment. How is he doing?
Yeah, he's doing really well now. So he's had four rounds of different treatments, and he's had radiotherapy and lots of different pills and everything. But he's definitely on the home straight now. So
that's fantastic.
Yeah, he's got his facial hair back, which is good.
Oh, good.
Actually, I don't think we mentioned how old is Will.
Will's 23.
23.
Yep. Wow.
So, you know, it's not a disease that just affects particularly old people like certain other cancers do, which is all to do with time and other things like that. But so it does affect people whether they're young and old. So, of course, if anybody wants to be a part of donating to Leukemia Foundation in order to help raise funds for those research projects, by all means do so. What sort of research programs are being done at the moment? Have we got any idea, or it's just always ongoing research?
Yeah, there's just always ongoing research, and it's one of our focal points that we do put a lot of funds into. So as soon as there's breaking news, it's definitely out there in the papers.
Yeah, well, as we said today, that great article in The Age, I'm just imagining cancer cells stripping away the bone, which is really quite horrific sounding.
It's a very graphic description, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
To be able to see it that close up.
Now, Catherine, back to your run. How did you feel on Monday morning?
Monday morning was a struggle. It definitely was hard to get out of bed. And my knees are suffering a bit now. But, yeah, it's made me hungry to get back out there and train hard and eventually tick off a full marathon in 2017.
Oh, cool. Yeah, the full marathon. It is a killer. Andrew, you've got the medal, haven't you?
I have it home.
Now, normally I wear my medal for at least a week everywhere I go.
Yes, he does.
For a week after the actual marathon itself. And I can tell you, you will not get that medal any other way than running into the G. Now, I know you've got the half marathon medal, so it'll hang with the other ones, Catherine, but you will not get a medal any other way other than if you go to a garage sale and somebody's selling them off. In which case, I suggest buy as many as you can.
Well, like, I really like getting the T-shirt at the end that says Melbourne Marathon 16, but then I looked on eBay and you could get the Melbourne Marathon 13, 14 for about $50. So I might just do that next time.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
I got 14.
You could have got all of them and said doing it for years and,
Well, I think, you know, maybe we should actually have T-shirts made up Marathoner Bad to the Bone, which would certainly... well and truly express it. But it's a great effort that you've done there.
Absolutely.
The feeling of actually, how did you feel when you ran into the MCG? What do you think, Catherine? What was that like?
Yeah, it was really exciting running into the G. And it was also rewarding knowing that you had some eyes on you with our family and friends in their support. So, it was awesome.
And just actually doing that lap, have you ever done a lap of the G before?
No, I've never. I've sat there and watched my footy team play, but I've never actually physically run on that ground.
Yeah,
so.
I know. You've been on the hallowed turf.
Yeah.
Andrew, one of the things that I've noticed, and you know, you're sort of coming back in on St Kilda Road and you can see the G and then you do this part of a loop which brings you back around the tan. It's very demoralising. It's to do with a mental journey as much as the actual physical part. And that's a really tough point where you're sort of turning around and you're going away. I mean, there's an analogy there, of course, between the mental journey that Will has been through, as well as, because you know, knowing Will so well, he would have had good days and bad days as well.
I think, like, running a marathon, you get to that point as you speak of, and you're 30, 35 Ks in, that's 3 hours of work, and you can't just turn around and let that all go to waste. You've just got to keep working as much as it hurts. And it's kind of like similar to Will's situation. You know, he's had 23 years of his life, which he's enjoyed. And, you know, he's going to have some really dark days and really tough days. But it's important to know that the next one's going to be better. He's going to work through the tough times and it will hopefully be better in the end. And kind of the same as a marathon.
And there's this great point, sorry Paul to interrupt, there's this great point where you come down around Brunton Avenue. It's actually quite dark because it's the south side of the MCG. And then you turn left and you go down onto the MCG turf. And then the whole thing just explodes in light because you're suddenly in the sunlight again. That feeling is amazing, isn't it?
It's just... you've got no energy up to that point and you're absolutely running on reserve gas. And then as soon as you turn out MCG, it's like you get a complete second wind and the sun's out, you know, everyone's around and so many other people that are around you. And
people are cheering,
I was, you know, sprinting that the last lap, even though, you know, I was dead for the last half an hour. Mm. It was ridiculous.
Was Will able to be there? Could he watch you guys?
Yeah, he was there.
Oh,
so.
Sweet.
Yeah.
He actually,
like, I was running with my phone, and he actually called me with about a kilometre left. He's like, boss, where are you? We're going to get breakfast. Hurry up. He's like, are you done yet? Anyway.
All right, look, it's great having you in the studio. Please check out our podcast afterwards, and we'll have links to raise money for Leukemia Foundation. Okay, and tonight on The Informer, we'd like to thank Dr. Mark Stouve from the Burnett Institute, also Catherine Newton, half-marathon runner, Andrew Morris, marathon runner, soon-to-be marathon runner, Kelly Cameron from the Leukemia Foundation. Coming up next, of course, we have World Wide Wave, and of course, The Informer will be on tomorrow night at 6:30. I'm David Gale.
I'm Paul McClure. Good night.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.